Darkcast Network. Indie pods with a dark side.
On the night of August 31st, 1976, a three-year-old girl crept out of bed and witnessed her father wrap his hands around her mother's throat, push her against the wall, and drag her out of sight. The next morning, her father, Ralph Otto, told her and her sister that her mother, 24-year-old Patty Otto, wasn't coming back. For years, Suzanne wasn't sure what she had seen that night, but as she became an adult, she started questioning it more and more. Then, in 2021, a Facebook post turned everything she thought she knew about her mother's disappearance completely upside down. Now, she's fighting three different states to find out what really happened to Patty Otto that night. When a person goes missing, there's a special kind of pain in the not knowing. I want to tell the stories of those who never came home. Today, I want to tell you the story of Patty Otto. I'm Kona Gallagher.
And I'm Ethan Flick.
And this is And Then They Were Gone. Welcome back, everyone.
Welcome back.
Thank you for joining us once again. I'm Kona.
And I'm Ethan.
And we're the husband and wife team behind this podcast. Each week, I tell you the story of an unsolved missing persons case. Ethan doesn't know anything about the case going into the episode and is here to provide his reactions and questions in real time, hopefully asking some of the same ones you have at home. Now, this story is one that I've kind of been aware of via Facebook for a few years now. But I finally decided to cover it because Suzanne is so close to getting answers about her mother's case. So it kind of feels like the more people who can hear about this, the better. I don't know. This story also has more weird twists and potential coincidences than almost any other case we've covered in the past 6 years.
So this case is just going to irritate me because I don't believe in coincidences.
Yeah. And, you know, I do. But like, these are so crazy that I don't know. Like, they're just on another level. Before we get into it, though, we've had a few folks join us over on Patreon. So we want to give them a shout out. Thank you to Stevie Lee R and Ann C. We really appreciate your support.
Thank you so much.
As a reminder, if you'd like to get our episodes ad-free and sometimes early, you can join us over on Patreon at any level, starting at just $2 a month. You'll also get a free copy of the ebook that I wrote. So now, let's get into the story of Patty Otto. Patricia Lee O'Malley was born on August 4th, 1952, in Lewiston, Idaho, to Thomas and Artis O'Malley. Lewiston is a small city in north-central Idaho, right on the Washington border, where the Snake and Clearwater Rivers meet. Patty grew up there with two sisters and a brother in a respected working-class family. Her father was a World War II veteran who became a firefighter, and her mother worked as an accounting clerk. Throughout her life, Patty was a good student and a regular churchgoer. The people who knew her describe her as outgoing, funny, talkative, and beautiful. She was the type of person who everyone thought would go on to do great things. When she was 16 years old, Patty was looking for work as a babysitter. It was something a lot of teenage girls did. But what Patty had no way of knowing was that this babysitting job would change the course of her entire life. Patty met a man named Ralph Otto. He was about 18 years her senior. And was looking for a babysitter for his girlfriend's children.
Ugh, gross.
Ralph quickly began grooming the teenager. He worked for the Forestry Service at the time and made good money, so he lavished her with gifts, including a car.
Just gross.
Yeah.
Like, what the hell? I mean, I know this was different times, but not that much different.
Yeah, this was in the 60s, but yeah, so gross. Now, Patty's parents did not approve of this relationship, but they didn't really know what to do about it either. And even Patty knew that at best, like, it wasn't socially acceptable, you know? So, like, she's in high school. And when prom came around, she wasn't taking her 34-year-old, 35-year-old, however old he was, boyfriend. So she, like, took another classmate to prom. Nevertheless, the relationship, in heavy quotes, survived. And Patty and Ralph married on October 17th, 1970, when Patty turned 18.
That's disgusting. I mean, so what? He's 37 at that point?
Yeah, something like that. Yeah.
Ugh.
It's so gross. And again, I'm not blaming Patty for any of this. She was literally a child. No. Like, so I don't want this to come off as victim blaming at all.
No.
Obviously.
We're blaming him.
Yeah. No, like, he's a creep. Their daughter, Natalie, soon followed, and a second daughter, Dallas, was born when Patty was 21. Now, Dallas now goes by Suzanne, so that's how I'm just going to refer to her throughout the rest of this. And Suzanne becomes a big part of this story later on. I don't know how long it was before the marriage started to deteriorate, but it seems to have gone bad pretty quickly. Ralph was a drinker and had been married before. His former wife later told police that the couple fought constantly and she got, quote, slapped around, end quote. Because of his drinking and his violent tendencies, Patty never left her children alone with Ralph. She loved her kids and she loved being a mom. Despite the nightmare marriage that she found herself in, Patty was working hard to give her girls the life that they deserved. Now, Ralph, like I said, he was well off. Like, I mean, not well off like, you know, generational wealth, but like, he had a good job. Like, mm-hmm. they were doing well. So Patty likely did not need to work, but she chose to work. So she got a job working at a local insurance agency. She also enrolled as a full-time student at Valley Business College, where she took night classes. By the spring of 1976, the writing was on the wall. Patty came to understand that her situation was untenable, so she filed for divorce. She got her own apartment and took both of her kids with her. She would go to work, take care of the girls, and then at night, she would drop them at her parents' house and go to class. During that time, she also reconnected with a man she had known in high school, Randy Benton, who had just come back from the military. But of course, it's not easy to make a clean break when you're in a bad marriage like that, especially in 1976. And I think that's really important because, like, 1974 is when the Fair Housing Act, like, finally included women. And, you know, she could actually even get an apartment on her own. Like, mm-hmm. women also couldn't get a credit card in their own name until 1974. So, like, it was not easy to get out of a bad marriage at this time. And Ralph wanted her back. So in an effort to do that, he checked himself into a rehab center. When he completed his treatment, the center called Patty and basically just said, okay, well, he's done. Come get your husband.
Oh, Jesus. Because that's all it takes, right?
Yeah.
Just go to a treatment center and then, oh, you're good for the rest of your life.
Exactly. And, you know, they were still legally married. She had filed for divorce, but, you know, it hadn't gone through yet. So they're like, okay, well, you're the wife. Come get him. And, you know, she did. Because, listen, it's 1976. She was under a lot of societal pressure to make her marriage work. And I'm sure there was part of her that wanted it to work if it could. You know, they had two girls together. She had been with him since she was 16.
Gross.
And yeah, but like right or wrong, like.
Yeah, no, I know.
There's an emotional attachment there. So that summer, Patty and the girls moved back in with Ralph. Ralph quickly went back to his old ways, though. He started drinking again and was violent with Patty. From what it sounds like, the reconciliation really never took off. Patty was apparently still seeing Randy, and Ralph was apparently also seeing somebody else.
Another 16-year-old?
I don't know how old she was. I probably don't want to know. Everything came to a head on August 31st, 1976. That night, Patty finished her classes, and around 11 p.m., she picked the girls up from her parents' house and brought them home. Suzanne, who was only 3 at the time, remembers part of that night. One detail that has stuck with her is that when they got home that night, instead of putting her and her sister to bed in their room upstairs, which was next to their parents' room, Patty put them downstairs. Suzanne has said that she thinks her mother knew there was going to be a fight and wanted them to be as far away from it as possible.
Yeah, that makes sense.
According to Suzanne, as soon as that downstairs door closed, she heard crashing and yelling coming from upstairs. And she was a curious kid, so she followed it. She went up the stairs and she looked through the wrought iron railings into the living room. She told Dateline, quote, I remember very clearly looking through those wrought iron rails and seeing her hit him in the face, him hit her back. And then he grabbed her by the neck, pushed her up against the wall, and drug her out of my sight, end quote. She ran back downstairs to her big sister, Natalie, who was only 5 years old herself. Suzanne was scared and didn't really understand what she had seen. Her sister comforted her and told her it would be okay, that they should just go to sleep. And then, Suzanne says, the next thing she knew, it was morning, and her father was waking them up, yelling at them to get their shoes because they had to go. That morning, he loaded the girls into the car and drove them across the river to Washington to his girlfriend's house, saying that they had to help her move. He told the girls their mom didn't want to be a mother anymore and wasn't coming home. Then he dropped the kids off at Patty's sister Alice's house and said that he was going to go look for his missing wife. Patty's family was understandably alarmed, but hoped that she had just taken some room to breathe. They decided to give her one evening to come back on her own. And when she didn't, her parents reported her missing to the Lewiston Police Department on September 2nd, 1976. The detective who caught this case was a young Lewiston officer named Tom Saline. He was 26 years old. He's retired now, and he told Dateline that he put more time and work into Patty Otto's case than any other case of his entire career. He went to the house and he met Ralph, who told him his wife had simply left after a disagreement. Interestingly, Ralph claimed that the night in question was September 2nd, not August 31st. So basically, he was trying to, you know, like avoid...
Just throwing off the timeline.
Exactly, yeah. Because he didn't want it to seem that he didn't report his wife missing for 2 days. He's like, oh yeah, no, she just left. Like,
That's why I didn't report it. Right.
His story was that he'd been drunk when Patty came home with the kids. He said that shortly thereafter, he heard a horn honk out front and that Patty grabbed her purse and just left. He hadn't seen her since, and he assumed she'd run off with Randy Benton. And here's a line that's right out of Officer Saline's 1976 report that tells you everything you need to know about how seriously this whole thing was taken. Police searched the property, wrote that they found, quote, no sign whatsoever of foul play, end quote, and advised Ralph to, quote, get off the drugs and whiskey so that his wife would return to him, end quote.
Jesus Christ.
Police figured that she'd cool off and come back. No one talked to Suzanne or Natalie, and the case was not pursued as a homicide or as a criminal matter at all.
I mean, they didn't even go and talk to her boyfriend?
I would imagine, given what I'm going to be saying later, that they probably did talk to him. But yeah, I don't know much about how that's turned out.
I mean, they must not have, at least initially, at least not at this point, because if they had, the stories wouldn't have lined up and they would have known that she was not with her boyfriend and also not with her husband. So she's missing.
Yeah. And it's interesting because Ralph really did try to like push this off on Randy.
Yeah.
A lot. He's like, I don't know, whatever happened to her. He was the one who was with her, didn't have anything to do with me. So yeah, those
it's deflecting. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, yes, they had to have talked to Randy at some point, but whatever they said and whatever didn't match up wasn't enough, apparently.
I mean, like that. That's crazy to me. Like the initial call.
Yeah.
By her parents saying that she's missing. You go talk to the husband. The husband said, oh, no, off with Randy. If you go and talk to Randy and Randy's like, no, I haven't seen her in a couple of days, haven't heard from her. Really?
Like somebody's got to be lying,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, but then you go back to the husband and just be like, get off the drugs and alcohol and she'll come back to you. Like,
yeah.
That, fuck.
No, and that's not even, like, we are not even into how insane this gets. Now, unfortunately, Patty's disappearance, in addition to not really being taken seriously by police at first, also wasn't considered newsworthy at all. There weren't any news articles written about this. There was like one short little blurb in one newspaper, and that was about it, despite the fact that like her family was a well-respected family within the community. They had been there forever. Like, these are well-established people, and like, still nobody cared. Like, that's how, no, like, that is how little people gave a shit about like a woman going missing. For our purposes here doing this podcast, that also means that I don't have contemporaneous sources
right.
to work with, right? So like, I can't really see like what police were thinking at the time or, you know, what they were investigating, like what avenues they were going down, any of that.
Well, except for that note that you just read, and it clearly shows that they were not taking this seriously and they didn't give a shit.
Well, yeah. And so we have some of the documents available that I'll get to later that Suzanne has been able to get over the years. And then, you know, what we know about this is really just from like interviews that Suzanne has given. Everything's so pieced together, you know?
Yeah.
What it comes down to is I don't really understand or know why police weren't picking up on the substantial amounts of alarming evidence that began to pile up. This message is sponsored by Greenlight. Every true crime story has money somewhere in the mix. The motive, the pressure, the moment everything goes wrong. Teaching your kids about money isn't just smart parenting, it's protection. Because today, money doesn't live in a vacuum. It's tied to where your kids go, how they move through the world, and what happens when something goes wrong. Greenlight is a debit card and app for families, but it's more than just a money tool. It's a safety net for teaching kids about money while also helping protect them before bad habits, bad actors, or real-world risks take hold. We've been using Greenlight for our older kids for years. We are such big fans of this product. It makes giving them allowances easy, and we know where their money is going. Start your risk-free Greenlight trial today at greenlight.com/ATTWG. Don't wait to teach your kids real-world money skills. That's greenlight.com/ATTWG to get started. greenlight.com/ATTWG. Starting a business is hard, but Shopify makes it simpler. All the tools you need to launch are already included and ready from day one. I know I have a lot of ideas in my head, and it's so hard to execute them, but Shopify's templates and AI tools will get you a stunning site up and running with no coding needed. What I love about them is how much they really try to streamline and improve the customer experience. Shopify checkout means that more customers actually buy, and returning ones can do it in a single click. And Shopify's there to support you as you're building your site. If you've got questions, their built-in AI assistant Sidekick is ready to help you build, troubleshoot, and just keep moving. Shopify powers millions of businesses worldwide, from household names like Mattel and Gymshark to small businesses just getting started. Shopify makes it easier than ever to have a beautiful, functional site for your business. All you need is the idea. Shopify handles the rest. Start your free trial at shopify.com/ATTWG. That's shopify.com/ATTWG to start your free trial. Shopify.com/ATTWG. Your body is already sending you signals, and for me, the signals are loud. The afternoon crashes, the plateau at the gym, the sleep issues that won't resolve. Jevity helps you look under the hood and actually address them. Jevity is the first all-in-one precision health membership that goes beyond the traditional healthcare system, which is designed to react, not to prevent. You go in once a year, get a basic panel, and here, everything looks fine. But fine is a low bar. It means nothing is critically wrong right now, not that something isn't coming around the corner. Heart disease, metabolic dysfunction, hormonal decline, these don't show up overnight. They develop quietly, sometimes for years, while the system tells you that you're healthy. With your Jevity membership, you get a dedicated three-person care team, including a longevity specialist and clinician, to guide your health journey. You get full-body testing beyond blood work, including gut microbiome analysis, advanced genetic testing, cancer screening, and more. Right now, we're offering our listeners 20% off your purchase if you go to our link, gojevity.com/gone, and use code ATTWG. That's gojevity.com, gojevity.com/gone to get 20% off your purchase with promo code ATTWG. Witnesses who came to the Otto house in the days after Patty vanished reported seeing a tarp and a shovel and a cushion missing off of one of the sofas.
Yeah, that's standard, right?
Yeah, just normal stuff. And on September 4th, her wedding rings were found in Ralph's coat pocket, which was hanging in his bedroom. Now, all of this is in the police report. So, like, this isn't just, like, rumors that have been passed down.
Well, yeah, because you said witnesses, but then you're saying that the rings were found by a police detective or somebody.
I don't know who they were found by, but whoever found it made it into the report. Yeah,
Jesus.
Yeah. Another thing in that was in the police report, or, you know, the police file that Suzanne ended up getting, was a letter written by a woman named Verna Eddy that said Ralph Otto had choked and raped her while, quote, laughing like a madman. Now, what I don't know is, like, when that allegedly occurred.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that was, you know, years before, if it was years after, if it was around this time. I don't have a date on that. But it just goes to show that, like, people were very alarmed by Ralph Otto and the type of person he was. And again, that's how we got the statement from his ex-wife saying that she had gotten slapped around. Like, that was all in the police file, too. So, like, police were aware of his history of violence, or an alleged history of violence at the very least. But
nah, let's not look into it.
Yeah. A few years ago, Suzanne started a Facebook group called Patty's Voice, and in it, she has posted some of the documents from the police file. One of the documents she posted is handwritten interview notes from an interview that Captain Dwayne Aylor did with Ralph. On this piece of paper, it says, quote, "I am a very violent person. I'm a very violent person. I get all worked up over certain things," end quote. This is ostensibly a quote from Ralph. And Ralph, it should be noted, was allegedly under the influence of drugs and alcohol during this interview. He also talked about Randy, the man Patty was seeing, saying, quote, "If I found him Tuesday, I was going to kill him, just outright kill him. He was going to be a dead man. The hate I have in my guts for him, if I just had 5 minutes with him, you wouldn't have to worry about him anymore, or her," end quote.
So he's basically admitting that he would have killed her, or him. He would have killed him, and potentially already killed her.
Yeah, I mean, or he would have if he found them together. You know, basically you wouldn't have to worry about him or her, meaning if he found them together, then yeah, he would have killed them both.
Yeah, well, I mean, he's very clearly admitting that he's a violent person. I mean,
right. I mean, he said it twice.
And when was this interview?
Like a couple of days. I mean, within the first week, I
okay,
think.
So again, like, he's admitting that he would have killed one or both of them.
Yeah.
But they're still on the, well, you know, get off the booze and drugs and she'll come back to you.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
No, it is. And it's even worse. It's even worse than that. He also told Captain Aylor in this, you know, interview that he owned a .357 Magnum and that he assumes Patty took it with her.
Oh, come on. So he admitted that the murder weapon was missing, essentially.
A weapon.
Sure.
Yeah. But, I mean, honestly, I wouldn't necessarily think that that was the murder weapon because, you know, Suzanne, Natalie, nobody remembers hearing a gunshot. There's no evidence of that happening in the house. So
just tarp and a missing cushion. So
yeah, for sure. For sure.
And, you know, who's to say that this is several days later,
mm-hmm,
before they even had access to this, before they even knew about it.
Right.
And he took the kids to her sister's and left the kids there to go, quote unquote, look for his missing wife.
Yeah.
Right. So what was he doing then? He's fucking cleaning up. And this is the 70s. It's not like they did. Well, I mean, even the initial detectives, they didn't do any forensics whatsoever.
No, and I don't think there was ever a forensic search of the home. I mean, from what I'm kind of piecing together, it seems like they looked around, you know?
And didn't bother to make note of the tarp.
Yeah. And I don't know if the
couch cushion.
I mean, right. And I don't know if that was missing at the time. I don't, again, because I don't have the exact timeline of all of this. But yeah. Yeah. So basically he's trying to say that Patty took off, took the gun with her, and also she had $500. So like that was the money she was using to start her new life or whatever. Now, this is what makes this even crazier. Because what he said about finding Randy on Tuesday refers to Tuesday, August 31st. That day, Patty was late coming home from class, and Ralph thought that it was because Patty was with Randy. He allegedly took his gun, went to a local bar, and asked if anyone knew where Randy was.
Where is this information coming from?
So this is, well, yeah, so the police were called.
Oh, Jesus.
So that's where, so they already, like, knew about this. This is a known fact.
Okay.
So basically, he was, like, drunk, went to this bar, demanded, like, if anybody knew where Randy was, ordered a beer, was waving his gun around. The bartender, whoever, called the cops, was like, you know, this is a little much. And Randy apparently finished his beer and took off before the cops got there. And this is all on August 31st.
Jesus.
Police knew that on August 31st, Ralph was angry. He had a gun, but that wasn't enough. A few months later, a family friend told detectives that on December 4th of that year, 3-year-old Suzanne had said, quote, "Mama hit daddy, daddy hit mama, daddy carried her out," end quote. So this is 4 months after.
Mm-hmm.
This also made it into
the police reports.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But that wasn't enough. Now, somewhere during all of this, Ralph got a lawyer and
stopped talking.
Yeah, exactly. Then things got even crazier because clearly Ralph, like, was getting away with this against all odds, right? Like, even though he wasn't talking, police apparently weren't going with any of the other evidence that they had. But that wasn't good enough for Ralph. Ralph was still like, these cops, Celine and Captain Ayler, they're like, they're on my ass. I got to get them off. So what does he do? This is just so absurd that, like, I mean, I'm not, obviously, this is all awful. I'm not trying to make light of any of it, but it's genuinely absurd. Ralph put a hit out on them.
On the cops?
Yes.
Okay.
Ralph Otto tried to have the police officers who were investigating him killed. Specifically, according to Celine, Ralph went to a bartender and tried to find a mafia connection to take out both Captain Ayler and Celine himself. Now, apparently, this bartender had previously told Ralph that if he ever needed someone taken out, that he knew people. The bartender was talking out of his ass. Like, the bartender didn't know anyone. And so when Ralph was like, yeah, no, I do actually need somebody taken out, the bartender's like, okay, cool, cool, cool. Let me work on that for you. And then call the police.
I can't imagine a bartender in, like, Northwest Idaho is real connected with the mob.
I don't know.
I mean,
I don't know.
Look, I know the mob was big in the 70s, but I don't know about in that particular region.
Yeah. So investigators set Ralph up with an undercover state investigator posing as a hitman. And I read one article that said he was like a liquor investigator or something. Like, he wasn't a member of the FBI or, like, even a detective. I think he was, you know, usually
like
finding underage.
Board?
Yeah. But in any case, they set this guy up and he posed as a hitman and met with Ralph. He told Ralph that he'd only do one hit at a time, right? Like, he's not going to go and kill both of these cops at the same time. Ralph agreed and said that Captain Ayler was his first choice and paid him $250 to do the job with the promise of $750 more when it was completed.
$1,000?
$1,000.
Okay.
In 1976 money, you know, that would get you.
It's still not a lot of money.
I don't know. I think you could get a car with that. So on October 27th, 1976, which happened to be his daughter Natalie's 5th birthday, Ralph was arrested on attempted first-degree murder charges. He went to trial and was convicted and sentenced to 10 years. But even that wasn't enough to get charges brought against him in Patty's disappearance.
Like, they didn't even do any further investigation.
It doesn't sound like it.
They were just like, all right, we got you on this. We're good.
Yeah, which to an extent, okay. But if he got like a life sentence.
Yeah.
But he got 10 years.
Or if they did any investigation into
yeah.
her disappearance at all.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of those things where it's like, okay, we've got him on this charge. Now, let's do a heavier investigation and bring additional charges
right.
at that same trial.
Right.
Stack it all up.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Like, yeah, exactly.
Why
show the jury,
just...
like, this guy is a bad guy. But they didn't do that. Now, Ralph had a good lawyer because, again, he had money. Though he did get convicted, he appealed, and it went all the way up to the Idaho Supreme Court, who voted to overturn his conviction.
Based on what?
Their reasoning was that hiring a hitman and paying the money was, in their view, still just planning and preparation, not an actual attempt in the legal sense. And he was charged and convicted with attempted first degree murder. But there is, so because at the time,
conspiracy
Idaho,
wasn't,
solicitation
option.
They didn't have that on the books.
Jesus.
And so the Supreme Court was like, well, he didn't actually attempt to murder anyone.
So back then you could just plan.
Yeah.
You could plan a murder and be totally fine as long as it didn't happen.
Right.
Now the charge would be conspiracy to commit.
Yeah, or solicitation.
Or whatever.
Depending on,
Yeah.
But no, they just didn't have that at the time. So his conviction got overturned and he ended up only spending 4 years in prison. Now, when Ralph was in prison, Suzanne and Natalie stayed with Patty's sister. When he was released, he was able to get them back. And by that point, the girls didn't know what to think. So they're like 10 and 7 at this point. They're still very young. Patty's family had been prohibited from talking about her by Ralph, which I don't know why they listened to him.
Yeah, like he's in jail.
Yeah, I don't know.
He probably killed her. Like, what the fuck do you mean?
I mean, I think my guess is that in order for the girls to stay with them and for Ralph's family not to fight for custody, the agreement was you can't talk about Patty, like you can't talk about Ralph kind of thing. I don't know. That's just speculation on my part. But anyway, so they had been with Patty's side of the family while he was in prison. Ralph gets out, takes the girls back, and then shortly realizes that he's not really cut out to be a single father.
Weird.
So he sent them to live with his sister. So now they're on Ralph's side of the family. Now, and that's when Dallas became Suzanne. So she changed her whole name because it's really interesting. They ended up growing up with this aunt and were very, very close with her, you know, until she died in, I believe, 2023. The girls grew up with her, called her mom, very close to her. They ended up taking her last name, which was her married name.
Yeah.
So like they were no longer Otto's. Dallas became Suzanne. So her whole name was changed. Natalie stayed Natalie, but had a different last name. From what I've read, Ralph's sister believed in his innocence, you know? And so they grew up with a family that believed that their father was innocent and that Patty really just took off.
But they with Ralph's sister, they had a decent life?
Yeah, it sounds like it. I mean, it sounds like she was a lovely woman.
Good. Well, look, this is a terrible, horrible story.
Yeah.
But at least there's some sort of bright spot in this.
You know,
it's not like the kids, even Suzanne having that extremely traumatic memory from when she was 3 years old, you know, seeing her mom getting beaten and dragged away, like that's awful.
Yeah.
At least that's the only memory that she had. Cause you know what I mean?
Right,
like it could have been.
It could have been worse.
A lot worse.
But it could have been better, too, because apparently that's the only memory she has of her mother.
Yeah.
Which is tragic. But yes, it does sound like they were actually able to grow up and have, you know, a fairly decent life for a while because things are about to get really bad again. After his release from prison, Ralph wasn't doing well. He, you know, there was one article that I found where Ralph was interviewed after his release. And because, you know, him getting his conviction overturned was a big story, as you can imagine, right? And so he's like, this was terrible. You know, I was unjustly imprisoned.
Sure.
And I'm going to move to Australia and start over because I can't get a job here. So basically, you know, he even though his conviction was overturned, nobody really wanted to hire him. But he said in this interview specifically, he's like, the one good thing that came out of this was that I got sober while I was in prison. He's, you know, he said I'd struggled with alcoholism, but now I'm sober. But I can't get a job, might move to Australia. Now, there are no other articles, but basically, it sounds like he still was not able to get a job. He did not stay sober and just spiraled down, you know? Suzanne has said in recent years, she's like, I really, truly think that the guilt started to eat him up. And that's a big part of it. I think that's a very generous way of looking at it personally, but, you know, she was there, I wasn't. In any case, things started to spiral. He ended up getting arrested for theft. and this was in 1983. While he was in custody at the Clearwater County Jail, he had a heart attack and died.
Are you kidding me?
Yeah, in 1983. He was never charged in Patty's case, and he was never even officially named a suspect in her disappearance. Whatever he knew about what happened on August 31st, 1976, died with him about 7 years later. As a lifelong vegetarian, eating healthy isn't a willpower problem for me, it's a setup problem. Until I found Factor. I work from home, so theoretically I could be cooking my own meals every day, but the truth is I don't. So ever since I've been using Factor, it's really been a game changer because now I can actually eat healthy at home with very little effort. Plus, Factor has meals that are built around your goals, whether it's weight loss, overall nutrition, more protein, GLP-1 support, the list goes on. And what I love is that they're fresh and never frozen. They have over 100 rotating weekly meals, including newly launched ready-to-eat salads. I've talked before about the miso edamame salad. It's incredible. If you're ready to get started, head to factormeals.com/ATTWG50off and use code ATTWG50off to get 50% off and free daily greens per box with new subscriptions only while supplies last until 9/27/26. See website for more details. I'm really excited to tell you we've got another banger from Kensington Publishing and author Noelle W. Eiley, who wrote Ask for Andrea. Her new book, Gray After Dark, is incredible. It's a thriller that's inspired by a real crime, the 1984 abduction of Olympic biathlete Carrie Swenson, who was kidnapped and left stranded in the wilderness by her attackers. The story follows Miley, an injured Olympic hopeful who's spending the summer training in Idaho's remote Frank Church wilderness when she's abducted during a morning run. Suddenly, she's trapped in an off-grid cabin, miles from help, forced to rely on her athletic training, instincts, and sheer determination to stay alive. This book doesn't come out till June 30th, but I was so excited to get an early copy. And what I loved is it's not just a thriller about escaping a captor. It's also a battle against wilderness itself. Miley's stuck in the woods and realizing that surviving one more day is far from guaranteed. So if you're a fan of Freda McFadden, Karen Slaughter, John Mars, or true crime stories, Gray After Dark absolutely deserves a spot on your list. You should never have to choose between a home that looks great and one that's actually livable. Between pets, kids, spills, some of which are done by my kids, many of which are done by me, the new Ruggable All-in-One Rug delivers premium design with the peace of mind of being machine washable, stain resistant, and non-slip. I came to the conclusion long ago that I need machine washable rugs in my home. And Ruggable has the most beautiful designs, whether it's vintage inspired, neutral, modern, whatever your style is, you will find it at Ruggable. They're stain resistant for everyday spills, but they have a high quality look and feel. And most importantly, they're durable and built for your life. Refresh your home at Ruggable.com. Get 10% off your first order site-wide with promo code ATTWG at Ruggable.com. That's Ruggable.com and use code ATTWG at checkout. Though the sisters basically believed what their family had told them over the years, questions began to nag at them. When they were 18 and 20, they walked into the Lewiston Police Department and asked for both their mother's missing persons file and their father's file. They decided that they were going to figure out what happened themselves. Suzanne says that almost the moment she started reading, she realized that the story she'd been told her entire life was a lie. As she put it, quote, "It was very apparent my father was responsible just by reading the reports," end quote.
And how old is she at this point?
She's 18.
18, okay.
And Natalie's 20.
Gotcha.
The sisters dug into their mom's case together for years. But then, in 2006, a horrible tragedy hit this family again. Natalie died from carbon monoxide poisoning in a freak boating accident.
What the hell?
According to news reports, it's even worse. Natalie, her husband, Jeff, their 12-year-old son, Jonathan, and Jonathan's friend, Kyle, were boating on Clearwater Lake over Memorial Day weekend when a storm hit. They were on a motorboat. They covered up in order to avoid the rain and died of carbon monoxide poisoning. Jeff was driving the boat at the time, and then it crashed into shore.
I don't even understand how that happens.
Yeah, so I read a little bit into it because like one of the articles kind of explained how carbon monoxide poisoning on boats was like a really big danger that a lot of people just don't know about. And yeah, apparently it has to do with the onboard motor. Like if you have an onboard motor, I guess if you cover, you know, if you cover up when you're on it, it is just really quick and easy to die of carbon monoxide poisoning. Now, losing her sister, her nephew, her brother-in-law, like that, of course, was devastating for Suzanne. All of the case files and their mother's belongings were at Natalie's house. There were boxes and boxes, but Susan says she wanted nothing to do with any of it. She put them away and didn't look at it again for years, which, again, I completely understand. You know, at some point, Suzanne got married. She had kids of her own. She had her own family to deal with as well, right? She's dealing with the grief of, you know, she's lost both biological parents. She's lost her sister, who was, you know, the one who was really helping her in this fight to find out what happened to their mother. You know, she lost her nephew, her brother-in-law. And then in 2013, about 7 years after Natalie's death, her 17-year-old son died by suicide.
Oh, my God.
Like, objectively, this is just too much for one person to deal with. I don't know how she continued to put one foot in front of the other or work or raise her other children, much less investigate her mother's decades-old disappearance. So for years, Patty's case sat dormant once again, until something insane happened in 2021. Suzanne was just in bed, scrolling through Facebook one night, as a lot of us do, and she came across a pencil drawing of her. She's just scrolling. She sees this drawing. It's her face. And she's like, wait, what the hell is this? So she reads the post, and the drawing belonged to a Jane Doe nicknamed Finley Creek Jane Doe. But it was her face. She told Dateline that her first thought was, quote, why would somebody draw me? It's like they took my picture at 30 and penciled it, end quote. Then she read the post, which was put up by the Finley Creek Doe Task Force. It said that the doe had been found in 1978 wearing red pants and a white blouse, the same outfit that Patty Otto was last seen wearing. She still didn't understand what was happening, though. Like, her brain could not put the pieces together.
Yeah.
Like, why had this group drawn a picture of her and included details that matched her missing mother? Like, she did not understand, because I need to make it so clear how, because if you look at this case online, you will see a picture of Suzanne, the drawing of the Finley Creek Jane Doe, and then a picture of Patty. The drawing doesn't look like Patty. It looks like Suzanne.
That's weird.
It was. It's so, like, that's why, like, her brain just, like, could not compute. So she messaged the page and was like, hey, like, what the hell is going on here? So, of course, she also woke her husband out and was, like, freaking out completely. So she messaged the task force and then kind of began to put the pieces together. On August 27th, 1978, two hunters in the forest near Finley Creek, which is about 18 miles north of LeGrand in eastern Oregon, came across human remains in a shallow grave on a hillside. They saw a human skull and rib bones poking out of the dirt. In and around that grave, investigators found a skull and spine, rib bones, part of the pelvis, arms and legs, and light blonde or brown hair. They also found pieces of white cloth with what looked like red hearts printed on it, a white halter top, red knit pants in a size 15-16 that appeared to have been altered, and ankle-high shoes. And near the pelvic bones, they found small bones. Bones that told them that the woman had likely been pregnant. And here's the thing. At the time, in 1978, Patty's family was actually told about this body. Detective Celine drove Patty's parents to Oregon because investigators thought that the remains might belong to Patty. Suzanne was 5 at the time, and she remembers her grandparents coming home from that trip absolutely shattered, saying they found a blonde-haired, short woman in red pants and a white blouse, but that it wasn't Patty. The remains were skeletal, so obviously they couldn't, you know, identify her. So it was also before DNA. So Oregon State Medical Examiner William Brady relied on x-rays. And according to him, the x-rays didn't match Patty.
What x-rays?
In September 1978, he compared Patty's dental records and concluded, quote, "The skull is clearly not that of Patricia Otto," end quote. His reasoning was apparently based on the fact that Patty's wisdom teeth had been removed, but that Jane Doe still had her wisdom teeth.
Okay. Reasonable conclusion.
Well, exactly. I mean, you can't just grow more wisdom teeth after you've gotten them removed.
Right.
But Suzanne later discovered that the only basis for that belief was a handwritten note on the envelope of Patty's x-rays, suggesting, in her view, that Patty likely needed to have her wisdom teeth removed, not that she already had. Suzanne also says that the note wasn't even written by the dentist. It was written by a friend who'd gone to the dentist with her mom. But no one knew that in 1978. So Patty's parents made peace with the fact that this random woman with the red pants and the white shirt wasn't their missing daughter. And no one ever found out the identity of Finley Creek Doe. In 1990, the Oregon State Police and the district attorney basically gave up.
I have a question.
Yeah.
On the Doe.
Uh-huh.
Were they able to determine a cause of death?
No.
So it wasn't like there was a bullet hole in the skull?
No. Okay. They ordered the remains cremated and the evidence destroyed because of the age of the case.
Oh my God. Are you kidding me? Why?
The report says, quote, "It could not be determined how the victim died, nor was the victim identified. Case closed," end quote.
Why would you destroy the evidence, though?
Isn't that insane? Just like to save space.
And this was in
1990. So 12 years.
Right. But technology was already advancing in 1990. Why wouldn't they, like, DNA was already a thing.
I know.
Why wouldn't they just hold on to the evidence and put it in storage?
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
They were a small office and needed the space,
I guess. Buy a fucking warehouse.
I know. So the bones that could one day have been DNA tested were burned. But somehow, the story gets even crazier. So after Suzanne came across the Facebook post in 2021, she started looking to old newspaper articles about the Jane Doe. In one, it said that it was two hunters who found the body. And the hunters were from Milton Freewater, Oregon, which is apparently a pretty small town.
Okay.
The newspaper article named the hunters. One of those names was Lee Parr. So Lee Parr from Milton Freewater, Oregon. Suzanne goes, wait a minute. I know somebody named Lee Parr. From Milton Freewater, Oregon.
Get the fuck out.
It was the name of Suzanne's husband's grandfather.
What?
The other person who was there that day, the second hunter, was Lee Parr's 8-year-old son. That little boy was Suzanne's father-in-law.
Holy shit. You've got to be kidding me.
Suzanne immediately called her father-in-law and was like, hey,
do you remember finding a fucking dead body when you were on a hunting trip with your dad?
Yeah, that's exactly what she asked. And he said, how do you know about that? I've never told you anything about that, end quote. And he said, yes, that was him because, you know, when you're 8 years old and you find a body, you don't forget it. And Suzanne said to him, quote, I think you found my mother, end quote. Now, apparently, after her father-in-law and his dad found the body, they had been told by police or somebody that it belonged to an elderly lady who had, like, been picking berries and had gone off the path and gotten lost and died.
Who was also pregnant?
Well, I mean, they didn't know all that, you know, like they never knew any of that. Right. So they were just told that. And so, yes, that was like a crazy traumatic thing that happened to them. But there was nothing in her father-in-law's mind that would have ever connected that to his daughter-in-law's missing mom.
Yeah.
You know, especially since it was probably like another 30 years, 40 years before he even met Suzanne. As Suzanne dug into the actual Finley Creek case file, she and her cousin, who started helping her with the case after Natalie's death, found something strange. Patty Otto isn't mentioned in the Finley Creek homicide report at all. As Suzanne put it, quote, "It doesn't say she was ruled out. It doesn't say she was presented. It says nothing about Patty Otto," end quote. And it was actually Suzanne's cousin, Jennifer, who found out why the connection between Finley Creek Doe and Patty was ruled out. When she was putting the files in date order, she caught a problem. There were two different Jane Does in Oregon that were found around that time. One was found buried near Lewis and Clark College in Portland, and the other one was the Finley Creek Jane Doe in eastern Oregon. The first body, the one that was buried near the college, was eventually identified as a woman named Annette Willis, and she was identified through x-rays that featured extensive dental work.
Mm-hmm.
She had somewhere around 11 fillings. So it was like pretty easy,
yeah,
you know, to compare those x-rays with Annette Willis's dental x-rays, right?
Right.
But when Suzanne looked closer at the dental records for Finley Creek Jane Doe, they showed the exact same 11 fillings as Annette Willis. Her belief is that the dental comparison used to rule Patty out may have been run against the wrong body entirely. So yeah, she thinks that basically instead of running Patty's x-rays against Finley Creek Jane Doe's x-rays, they ran them against Annette Willis's x-rays. And beyond the fillings, like the shape of the jaw, like nothing matched, you know?
Yeah.
KTVB reached out to Oregon State Police about the alleged record mix-up, but they said they had, quote, nothing to provide, end quote.
I mean, look, it clearly doesn't seem like they're the best at keeping records, so
yeah.
That's not surprising that they wouldn't know or have any way to look back and say, oh yeah, that was our bad.
Yeah, I don't know. So, but you know, that's not to say that Oregon State Police have completely dismissed Suzanne's theory. In 2021 and 2022, the Volunteer Doe Task Force brought cadaver dogs out to the Finley Creek site. The dogs alerted on multiple spots, including down by the creek bed below the gravesite. The theory was that decades of erosion on that floodplain could have carried bone fragments downhill into the creek. On the strength of those alerts, Oregon State Police agreed to go excavate. On August 16th and 17th, 2022, an OSP forensic team excavated the original gravesite and the two spots the dogs had flagged, sifting the dirt through screens looking for even the smallest bone fragment they could pull DNA from. But they only found animal bones. OSP posted on Facebook that nothing of evidentiary value was discovered. There was an article where Suzanne and some other people went down to where OSP had searched. And from what I could gather from the article, it seems like she just didn't think they searched a big enough area, basically.
Mm.
So when Finley Creek Jane Doe's remains were recovered in 1978, they didn't find an intact skeleton.
Right.
There are still several bones missing. So, like, there's absolutely a chance that there are still bones out there that belong to her. And that's really important because the Finley Creek Jane Doe was cremated in 1990. And as of right now, 2026, there's no way to test the cremains for DNA. Suzanne's only real hope of definitively proving that Finley Creek Jane Doe is her mother is if they find additional bones in the woods. But so far, none have turned up. And yet another twist, which isn't quite as insane as the fact that her father-in-law and grandfather-in-law are the ones who found her. The little Oregon town that had the Doe's body didn't have a crematorium in 1990, so the body was sent to the nearest one, which is in Walla Walla, Washington. Walla Walla, Washington happens to be where Suzanne has lived since 1999.
Oh my God.
So the remains that she believes belong to her missing mother have been just miles away from her for decades. They're in the custody of the Walla Walla County coroner, and they're labeled only as miscellaneous cremains with no Jane or John Doe on the books to explain them. Suzanne says that she has paid for DNA testing on the box of cremains twice, but the reality is that successful DNA extraction from human cremains has essentially never been done. Basically, the science just isn't there yet.
Yeah.
It might be in the future, but it's just not there right now. So the authorities won't give her an identification. They won't say, yeah, this is your mom. Suzanne is, in her words, quote, fighting three states to get justice for my pregnant mother, end quote. Patty Otto disappeared in 1976. Remains were found 2 years later that potentially matched her.
How far away was that?
Lewistown, Idaho to Findlay Creek, Oregon is about 145 miles, so it's like a 3 hour drive.
Okay, so 6 hours round trip, you know, burying a shallow grave.
Yeah, the grave was, I believe, 29 inches deep.
He didn't take her out there that night. That's too much time.
Yeah.
That's too much time for your kids to just be left alone sleeping and like.
Well, remember the next day he dropped them or he went to his girlfriend's house, right?
Yeah. I'm saying. Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. I think that he probably left the kids with her and then either had already had her like in the trunk of the car or whatever, yep. Or went back home.
Yep.
Where he had hidden her, her.
He took her to his girlfriend's house and then his sister-in-law's house.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
So that was like a full
day. That was a full day, yeah. I think they spent at least like one night
That's when it happened. That's when he took her out there.
Yeah. But there's also a possibility, too, like if we think the gun was involved, because I don't think that he shot her in the house that night on August 31st. And Suzanne said she saw him with his hands around Patty's neck, right? And strangulation would make sense, one, because of the type of violence, two, because, you know, it wouldn't necessarily leave behind a lot of evidence.
Yep.
What if she wasn't actually dead, you know?
That night, you mean?
Yeah. Like, what if she was just injured? What if, you know, whatever? And he took her out there somewhere and then shot her.
Yeah, I mean, maybe. I mean, that's a big leap, but, you know, like...
I just don't understand, like...
Why the gun went missing?
Yeah.
I don't know. Why the pillow on the couch? Why was that missing?
Yeah, that's a good
That could have been
too.
Used to muffle the sound of a gunshot.
Yeah, that's true as well.
But,
so it could have been later after the physical fight.
Yeah.
And after Suzanne had gone back downstairs with Natalie, you know, then, yeah, the gunshot could have happened. It could have been muffled with a pillow.
Right, but then where did it happen? Because that would have left, I mean, a 357 is a big bullet.
That's true. Yeah, we're not talking
a
22.
Right.
Right, where there wouldn't necessarily even be like an exit wound, for instance.
Yeah, I mean, with a 357, there would be.
Yeah.
Because you said she was tiny, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean.
I don't know. I mean, maybe a garage or, you know, something like that. I don't really know the layout of the house.
Right.
I mean, I wouldn't think outside just because, you know, somebody would have seen or heard something probably.
Mm-hmm. So then the remains are discovered, most likely her.
Yeah.
2 years later.
Mm-hmm.
They potentially mix up x-rays because you said Suzanne saw the x-rays from the dental records, right?
Yeah.
That had 11 fillings.
Yeah.
But the other Jane Doe also had 11 fillings, which obviously, like, that's clearly a fuck up.
Yeah, because she's like, what are the odds that two Jane Does have the same 11 fillings?
Right.
Like, that's insane.
Yeah. How did Suzanne and her husband meet? like, how did that happen?
I do not
know. So you're talking about a town 3 hours away from where Suzanne grew up.
Yeah.
And then she ends up meeting him, marrying him. Like, how...
Is that insane?
Yeah.
Yeah. And then, like, he didn't even know that his father had, like, found this body when he was 8 years old because it just wasn't something he talked about.
Yeah.
So he didn't know any of this. So, yeah. So, like, she grows up in Idaho. Her husband, I'm presuming, grew up in Oregon, or at least that's where his father grew up. They met somewhere at some point moved to Walla Walla, Washington, a third state, where the cremains that she believed belonged to her mother had been sitting since 1999, since 1990.
This is like a Stephen King novel or something, you know?
Crazy.
And then that's it.
Yeah.
And that's where we're at.
That's where we're at.
I mean, it's pretty obvious who did it.
Right. That's why I didn't have a section this week about theories.
Yeah.
Because, like, we don't need to waste everybody's time with, like, the only maybe she killed herself. Like, she didn't. No.
No, she was definitely murdered by Ralph.
Yeah.
It's just a question of how, when, we know the why.
Yeah.
And why the fuck the police didn't do anything about it. Didn't even investigate. That's the other thing. They didn't even bother to do a basic investigation.
Well, but that's the thing. No, they did. I mean, because
they looked around the house. That's not an investigation.
Correct. It's not like a forensic investigation. But, like, there are so many things in the police file that it's like, okay, you have this information.
Right.
Like, again, we're not talking rumors that have been passed down through a family for generations. We are talking about information from the police file.
That was all happening right then.
Yeah.
You have a report the day she went missing that he was in a bar waving a gun talking about killing her boyfriend.
Yeah.
Like, that was known.
That was known. Like, even though the
police or the missing person's report was a few days later.
Mm-hmm.
That was known then. Mm-hmm. You have this person who has a history of violence. You have this person who admits in an interview that he would have killed them had he seen them together. Why are you not digging further into this?
I mean, I would just say misogyny. Like,
well, yeah.
Generally, I think that's the answer. But I think a bigger part of it, too, is the fact that there wasn't a body. Now, a no-body homicide case is a lot more common nowadays because there have been a lot of successful prosecutions of them. But back in 1976, they were very few and far between. Now, the very first one, I had to look it up because I couldn't remember. The very first conviction in the U.S. was in 1957. So we're talking less than 20 years. And I don't know how many had really been done in those two decades. So I think that a lot of it was, well, we're building this case. When we find the body, then we'll have enough to arrest him. And they didn't find the body. And I think that misogyny and not having the body are like the two big contributing factors here.
I mean, I get not having the body, sure. But that's also potentially a foregone conclusion, like, or a putting the cart before the horse situation here, right? Like, at that point, it's a missing persons investigation.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, with clearly, the evidence is leading you towards her being dead. But why aren't you doing any investigation at all? Like, you're gathering evidence, but not doing anything with it.
Yeah.
You're not pressing him more. You're not.
Well, he did lawyer up.
Sure. Eventually.
Yeah.
But also after giving an interview saying that he would kill her and kill her boyfriend.
Yeah. Yeah.
You allegedly at some point interviewed the boyfriend and had to have found out that he didn't show up. He didn't take her away. So,
well, according to him.
Sure. But why aren't you pressing the both of them then?
Yeah.
One of the two of them is lying. Gee, do I believe the boyfriend of this missing person or do I believe the husband who was just down the street drinking a beer, waving a gun, saying he's going to kill the boyfriend?
Right.
I mean, I get that there's not evidence enough to pursue a homicide charge, but there's evidence enough to continue digging, to do more searches of the house, ask more questions about the fucking missing gun. Oh, she must have taken it when she left. Bullshit.
No, it's just insane, like, how many red flags there were in that police report that just apparently weren't enough. Ralph was arrested for the hit in October of 1976. So, like, 2 months later, right? He went to trial, I want to say, like, February of 77. But it was December of 76. So while he was awaiting trial, that the relative went to police and was like, hey, so Suzanne said that she saw.
Right.
Dad hit mom and mom hit dad and then him choke mom and, you know, drag her out. They didn't think they could use that. I get that she was three, but still.
Yeah, 3 years old, but so what? I mean, yeah. that's still witness testimony.
Especially if they had the testimony from the ex-wife saying that he was violent with her. If they had the letter from Vera who said that he raped her, like, I feel like there's stuff you can build on.
Yeah.
People have gotten convicted with a lot less evidence.
Right. And maybe we don't know this, but like, I want to know how much investigation was done with the initial report, given all of that information that we have.
Yeah.
Did they talk to any of the neighbors? Did any of the neighbors hear a pop? Like, you can't ask now, probably because most of the neighbors are dead.
Yeah.
But like, at the time, maybe a neighbor heard something that sounded like a gunshot, but was just like,
But no, yeah, and nobody in a safe neighborhood believes it's a gunshot when they hear a gunshot.
Right, but if you hear something like a loud bang and then the police the next day are like, hey, somebody's gone missing next door. Did you hear anything? Oh, yeah, you know what? Come to think of it, I did hear a loud noise. I looked out the window. I didn't think anything of it because it was quiet after that.
Exactly. Didn't see anything. Yeah.
Hey, did you happen to see Ralph loading anything into his car in the middle of the night?
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like, did they do any further investigation into this?
I don't know. But the whole time I was going over the parts about, you know, the dental x-ray mix-up and all that, it took me back to the case that we covered, Leah Roberts, who went missing in Washington State, so in this general area, and a mummified doe was found near where she went missing that had the same metal rod in their femur that she had, but it was ruled out because they said it was a male. And so I was like, well, was it though? Like, because you know what I mean? And yes, there are stories that potentially that doe was actually identified and, you know, was a male and whatever, but from what I've read, that's even questionable. So I don't know. But like, it's making me not trust anything anymore.
Yeah. Also a huge history of misogyny and just like, fuck it. She'll come back.
And, you know, to be fair too, like during that time period before we were all so connected, like people did just leave and like lose touch and, you know, whatever. Sure. So that's why you do have so many unidentified missing people from that era and so many people who went missing and were never found. A lot of them, no foul play happened to them. They literally just like stopped talking to their family, moved to a different state, and then died later.
That's also the number one fucking excuse of every murder that happened in that time frame was, they just left. I don't know.
Well, it's still the number one excuse.
Well, a lot easier to prove now that they didn't
it's harder to get away with now.
Yeah. But
yeah.
Yeah. Back then, you know, CCTV footage was rare, if at all. Yeah. Nobody had any cameras on their houses.
Right. We weren't carrying cell phones.
Nobody had cell phones. There was no social media. You're right. Yeah. I mean, people genuinely could leave and never be seen again, or they could get murdered.
Yeah.
And never be seen again.
Yeah.
But it's compounded by cops not doing their job.
Right.
Or not digging a little bit deeper.
Suzanne's only real memory of her mother is from the night she believes she watched her father murder her. She lost her sister, who was her only partner in the search, but instead of letting it break her completely, she turned her grief into a one-woman investigation that pulled a forgotten 1976 case and a forgotten 1978 Jane Doe back into the light. She tied them together with police files, dental charts, and decades of stubborn love. She told KTVB, quote, "I just feel like she's calling me to bring her home. And she's like, I've been trying to help you this whole time. I'm listening," end quote. August 2026 will mark 50 years since Patty Otto was last seen alive on the night she put her girls downstairs because she knew. She would be 73 years old today, and her daughter is still out there in Walla Walla fighting three states and the limits of forensic science, trying to do the one thing she has wanted since she was 3 years old, to bring her mother home. Patricia Patty Lee Otto has been missing from Lewiston, Idaho since August 31st, 1976. She is a white woman with dirty blonde hair and hazel eyes. At the time of her disappearance, she was approximately 5 foot 3 inches tall and 140 pounds, and she had a scar on her back. She was last seen wearing red knit pants and a white shell top, possibly printed with cherries. Patty was 24 years old when she went missing, and she may have been pregnant at the time. She would be 73 today. If you have any information about the disappearance of Patty Otto, please contact the Lewiston Police Department at 208-746-0171. If you have any information about the identity of the Finley Creek Jane Doe found near La Grande, Oregon in 1978, please contact the Oregon State Police. You can see all the sources for this episode along with photos and videos at our website, andthentheyweregone.com.
And be sure to follow us on social, And Then They Were Gone Pod on Facebook and at ATTWG Pod on Instagram and TikTok. If you like what we're doing, please subscribe and consider leaving a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. It will help new listeners find us. And the more people that listen, the more chances we have of bringing someone home.
And we'll see you here next week for a brand new episode.
See you next week.
And Then They Were Gone is hosted by Kona Gallagher and Ethan Flick. All research, writing, and editing is done by me, Kona Gallagher. Theme music is The Stork by Ketza. Additional music is provided by Kai Engel. And Then They Were Gone is a Little Monster production.
Hey, you can do it!